Welcome to Book Reporter Talks To, a podcast from the Book Report Network, where we host in-depth conversations with authors about the books that we love. We know authors cannot travel everywhere, so we want to bring them to you, wherever you may be. Hi, everyone. I'm Carol Fitzgerald from readinggroupguides.com, a website from the Book Report Network. I'm so excited to welcome you to our Bookachino Live event this evening, our book club event, with Danny Shapiro, the author of Signal Fires. Absolutely love this book, and I know your passion for it as well. Gotten so many notes about that. So Signal Fires was one of my 2022 Book Reporter Bets on selections. When it came out towards the end of the year, it was one of my last selections. And I got to interview Danny at the beginning of the year, and she was so terrific to chat with that I couldn't wait to bring her on to do a book club event. So let me start by saying this is a real book club, folks, and this is the kind where we're going to assume you finish the book because we're going to be talking spoilers. So I don't want anybody to sit there and say, oh, you didn't tell me that, like, this part of the book. Well, we're just assuming that you're all, you know, going to be doing this. I'll begin with a discussion with Danny, and then I'll be asking a few camera-shy people. We had some camera-shy people tonight that submitted some questions to me. Then we're going to take questions from the audience. So if you could remember to drop into the Q&A what your questions are, our voice of God, Tom Donadio, will be coming on later on, and he will be sharing those questions with us. So with that housekeeping behind us, I'd like to welcome Danny to the stage. And why don't you all give her a warm welcome as well from wherever you are.
Hey, everybody.
Danny, so great to see you again.
You too, Carol.
I know, that was so much fun. I guess we talked back in January, and I remember the conversation as being so much fun. And I was like, wait a second, the book's out in paperback. This is a great time to get her back to have our book group event. So let's start with, this is your first novel in 15 years, I guess 16 at this point, 15 between novels. Why so long between novels?
I started Signal Fires, well, God, I mean, it's a complicated question because I started out as a novelist. That my first book, my second book, my third book were novels. And then I wrote one memoir, Slow Motion, which I really wrote because I thought something's haunting my fiction. I need to get at it. It's something from my life, from my history that I just need to try to tell as a true story. And I use air quotes because I think sometimes novels are truer than memoirs in many ways to a writer's inner life. But after Slow Motion, I went back to fiction for two more novels that I was quite proud of. And then I just continued to be pulled back to memoir. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know why. It just was pulling me in and pulling me in and pulling me in. And I understand now much better why that was the case. I was digging for something that I couldn't quite apprehend, I couldn't quite get at. When I started Signal Fires, I had these characters. I knew them. I loved them. I loved the writing that I was doing. It felt really, to me, even at the time, it felt like my strongest work. But then I wrote myself right into a wall. Hmm. I was trying to tell the story. I was structuring it backward in time. I don't remember if you and I talked about this the last time we spoke.
Yeah, you were trying to figure out what to do. Yeah.
Well, I had this big idea of the way that I wanted to tell the story, and I was very committed to it, even though it was a totally flawed idea. Because if you keep on moving a story backward in time, eventually you run out of runway and you can no longer do it. So when we reach the end of the New Year's Eve 1999 section and Waldo is born, well, then there's no more Waldo if I keep on moving backward in time.
Right.
And I you'd think I would have thought of that, but I literally was so committed to this idea of the way that I wanted to tell the story that it never occurred to me that I was going to hit a wall. And I hit that wall and I hit it hard because there was nowhere else to go if I continued with that structure. And it had been so integral to the way I began that I couldn't figure out any other way. And that's the drawer.
Yeah. It's like, there you go. Well, you know, this book opens with this accident in 1985 when 17-year-old Sarah Wilf tosses the car keys to her brother,
15-year-old brother after they leave a party. And Misty Zimmerman, a friend, is along for the ride. You can picture this scene. You'd see exactly what's going to go on. Ends in a tragic accident. Claims Misty's life. Car hits this oak tree. Oak tree is very, very pivotal to the book. Sarah claims she was driving. She takes the rap for it. Thus bearing the seeds, this is really dangerous secret that starts in this family. And it's going to impact them for years, decades. Why start with there? Because you just got this whole scenario of the tree, the accident.
I was interested in the aftermath of the accident and what keeping that secret was going to cost the Will family. It was an accident for, I mean, we call it an accident, but, and it was an accident, but it was something for which Sarah and Theo were responsible. Mm-hmm. And, you know, because of the choices that each of them made that night, you know, practically children. I mean, Theo's 15, Sarah 17, Sarah had been drinking, so she didn't want to drive. So she gives Theo the keys. Theo's 15. He doesn't know how to drive. Mm-hmm. So some terrible choices are made, and it results in this tragic death of their friend. And there are no visible consequences. And because there are no visible consequences, they're this privileged family, their father's the doctor in the town, nobody questions what happened. So in a way, they get away with it, right. But they don't get away with it at all, because then they carry it with them throughout their lives. And because there is this kind of tacit, unspoken, it's not even an agreement, it's just something that the Will family does. They just never speak of it again. The kids take their parents' cues. I personally think that Ben took Mimi's cues, and that really it was just, if we don't speak of it, maybe it will almost be like it never happened. Mm-hmm. And I think we know that that's not how secrets work. And I'm very interested in how secrets work and in the keeping of that secret between with them as a family, that they never speak of it together, and that they never speak of it to anyone else ever. That's what creates this kind of corrosive, intense burden that each one of them is carrying. So it would be a very different kind of novel if I'd started with the accident, and then, you know, the next chapter opens and it's the next day, and then it's the day after, if it was a chronological novel in that way. But I wanted to see what would happen if we really sort of upended time completely, mm-hmm. and got glimpses into what, into the way that each of them navigated their lives.
And how it kind of haunts them, how it haunts them in different ways coming back. And you think you got away with it, but you didn't, because inside you still know what happened. But the whole family is like telling a lie. They're telling a lie to each other. They're all, but inside they all know somewhere we're each responsible for what happened here. We bear it.
I mean, to me, Ben and the realization that he has, I mean, Ben is a doctor. He's a very good doctor. He takes the oath that he took, the Hippocratic Oath, very seriously. And when he has the thought with absolute clarity that when he ran over to that car, he was running over to that car as a father, mm-hmm. who was thinking about his children and not as a doctor. Mm-hmm. And he couldn't have done anything that would have saved that girl's life. Mm-hmm. There was nothing that he could have done that would have made any difference. But in a way, that doesn't even matter to him. What matters to him is that he got a little window. I mean, we don't ever know who we're going to be, mm-hmm. in that kind of moment. Mm-hmm. In a moment where heroism or cowardice or, you know, strength, you know, we don't know. You know, we'd like to think that we would, you know, whatever, tackle that, you know, not just bear witness, but intervene. But we don't know. And so Ben has this awareness about himself, which is that he acted as a father trying to protect his children. And so that's the piece that he has trouble living with. I'm not sure that Mimi does have trouble with it in a way, but she is so private that she just pushes it somewhere in her inner life. But Theo and Sarah have to grow up, go to college, start their lives, become the young adults and the adults that they become, with the awareness that there is this young woman's death that is on their conscience. Mm-hmm. I think it's Sarah at one point who has the thought, you know, there are certain things that, you know, once they happen, they can never unhappen. If you kill someone, you are a murderer. If you, you know, it's a whole little inner monologue that she has with her, you know, herself. And, you know, she thinks of herself that way. She thinks of herself as someone who is responsible for the death of a classmate of theirs. And so they have to live with that. And they never feel like they got away with it. They know they didn't get away with it.
Yeah. And it's also so interesting because everybody in the town still sort of wonders, like, what you still, when there's an incident like that, you say, oh, that's the narrative that came out, but what's the narrative? And these right. days we know to say, is that really what happened that day? Is that really what happened?
Well, this story could never have taken, I mean, the accident happens in 1985.
Right.
If that accident happened in, you know, 2023, the entire story would have been completely different, mm-hmm. right? There would have been cameras. There would have been cameras everywhere they were. There would have been a rush to judgment. There would have been, you know, neighborhood threads on social media. The time that the story takes place in has a lot, is almost a character in and of itself.
Exactly. Yeah. Because you're going back and thinking, what was it like then? Oh, you were calling each other on what? Well, not cell phones. You were doing right. what? It wasn't happening the same way. You know, and then we get to Waldo, and I love the character of Waldo. I just love him because he's just his own person from a very young age. And his father doesn't understand him. His mother works to do that, but he's kind of bright and ethereal. He's just like, you know, Waldo. He's just walking around. And it's like he's taking care of himself at a very young age, like he's parenting himself and knowing what he needs and wants. And I love that he goes out one night with his iPad and he thinks that's all he needs. Like, if I just take my iPad and leave the house, I'm going to be fine. And I get the feeling you loved writing him as a character because he's just, there's this expressive part of him, but that people don't really understand him. And he's just a great character.
No, you're exactly right. I love Waldo probably more than any character I've ever written. And I loved writing him. And you know, he feels like he's a part of me. He's such a special boy, and his parents don't understand him, especially his father. Mm-hmm. But he also, you know, I sometimes when I do events in person, I'll say to an audience, you know, how many of you would go back to middle school, mm-hmm. you know, given the option? And pretty much no hands go up. I mean, every once in a while, there's an outlier. There's somebody who's like, I liked seventh grade, but nobody wants to be different at that age. And Waldo is different. And he's different in a way that is going to make him an incredibly interesting adult. But it also makes for a pretty unhappy childhood, especially because his father really doesn't understand him and loves him. But in his love is so misguided the way it comes out. He needs for Waldo, or desperately wants for Waldo, to be normal. Mm-hmm. And by normal, I mean, you know, he wants him to be the kid who's catching the outfield ball, not the kid who's like, you know, staring up at the sky and wondering about the constellations, because he thinks he'll be happier that way. And he thinks he'll be better off that way. But you can't dictate the kind of person that somebody is. And no matter how his father tries, he fails.
He's just this great, yeah. And he's sort of like, I'm going to take care of myself. I'm here for me. You don't want me to be like that? Well, I am like that. That's me. And I just love the way he moves through life. You know, at this time, there's so many bloated novels out there. Bloated. Too many pages. Too many words. Too many this. Could have been said like so much shorter. So you bring in Signal Fires in this slim 220 pages. And I'm like, whoa, so much is packed into there. Did you edit a lot, or are you this tight writer as you start?
With this book, it felt very spare to me. It felt like this was what it needed and wanted to be. Although I've got to say, I feel like over the course of my writing life, I've gone from much more, you say bloated, like much more, if one simile is good, three are better. You know, like when I started in my writing life early on, I still am so in love with language that I just wanted to digress and go, into all these different places. And I thought every thought that a character of mine would have, was fascinating. All these little tributaries and places that their minds would go. And book after book after book, I've become like a whittler. Like I just whittle it down and want the perfect word. I want the exact sentence. I want the distillation of character. And that's what I like to read too, most of the time, is that kind of, there wasn't one sentence in this book that I just read that wasn't absolutely necessary. It's that feeling. So I think that for me, it's moved in that direction. And so I certainly do some rewriting as I work, but I tend to move like one, two steps forward, one step back, two steps forward, one step back. And I'm always revising as I go. Mm-hmm. In the case of Signal Fires, because I had the 100 pages, in the drawer that was like rocket fuel when I came back to it, I knew what to do.
Mm-hmm.
I wish I had another one in the drawer, but that was the only one.
It's like, I'm looking around. Is there anything?
Is there anything? I'm opening all my drawers.
No drawers. Well, I've got Judy Leatherman from Lakewood, Ohio, has this to share. First, she says, I loved Inheritance, and now I really love Signal Fires. What a beautiful story. How did you decide to jump around in time like you did? I saw you mention Jennifer Egan suggested it. I think I normally wouldn't like that, but it really worked. Did you write it chronologically and then split it up, or how did it happen?
Thanks, Judy. That conversation I had with Jenny Egan, who's one of my dearest friends, happened once I put the pages back in the drawer, and I just was so in despair about that. Mm-hmm. And in my despair, I explained to her what I had been trying to do, to telling the story backward in time. And she said to me, but you're already upending chronology by telling the story by telling the story backward. Why continue to be chronological? You're forcing yourself into a chronology. It's just a backward chronology. And I knew she was right. But I didn't know how to do it. I wasn't ready to. Mm-hmm. And to me, that's one of the most mysterious things about this novel, is that it's not only that I wasn't ready to in terms of craft, that I hadn't learned yet how to play with time. And, I think one of my governing philosophies about all of this is that we live moving forward in time.
Mm-hmm.
At the end of this conversation, we will all be an hour older, and there's nothing we can do about that. We mm-hmm. are trapped in chronology, but it's not how we think.
Mm-hmm.
It's not how we walk around experiencing our inner worlds. Our inner worlds are comprised of memory and imagination and fantasy, and when we're telling ourselves a story in our heads, even we're mm-hmm. not telling it chronologically. It's just our minds are like that. And so I wanted to find a way to capture that. And for years, from the time I put those pages down until I returned to them, in a way I was learning how to do that
mm-hmm.
in my own work. But I also was learning a lot about different aspects of life. Like, Judy, you mentioned Inheritance. If I had not gone through that journey, and if I had not written that book, and if I had not learned that there can be somebody walking around in the world who is your biological father, who you have no idea even exists because you think you know who your father is. And I mean, my dad was my dad, but I came from a different person entirely. And I could have been walking past him at an airport and never known it. And so that contributed enormously to my thinking once I returned to the book of what does it mean that we are signal fires for each other? What does it mean that we feel like we know someone when we first meet them, or we feel like we don't? What are these connections between us, this thing we call chemistry? Like, what is it? And in terms of the process, no, I really wrote it as you read it. I did not write one storyline and then kind of chop it up. And once I returned to the novel, one of the things I realized is that I could return to that night in 2010. You know, that would be kind of the spine of the novel in a way, is when we leave, you know, we leave in 2010 after everything that has transpired in that first section, but we're going to return. And then when we return, it's going to be later that night. And then when we return again, it's going to be still later that night or the next morning. So I realized that I could create that kind of, you know, the feeling of these lily pads of time. And then from there, move into other moments in these characters' lives that would be particularly resonant. And really it was, and when I found the pages again, it was summer of 2020. The thing that allowed me to move back into the novel that they sort of exploded in my mind was I thought, who would these characters be now? Oh, Waldo would be a college student. Oh, Theo has a restaurant. What would he be doing during the pandemic? And, you know, what would Sarah be doing? And you know, would Ben still be alive? And if he is, where would he be? And what would he be? How would he be? That's what allowed me to return and to create all of those different layers in time. And it was exciting for me because every time I finished a section, I pretty much wait and think, what's now? Where now? Where do they go now? So for me as the writer, that was a discovery. And I really do think that when I'm discovering something as a writer, that's going to ultimately be exciting for the reader too. Not because they know that it's exciting for me, but because it's just simply exciting on the page to think, oh, now we're here.
It's got some energy to it. It's got some energy that got you to that point. And Judy asked, and she's curious, how did you pick the specific dates for each of the chapters and the events? Did you say, I mean, look, 1999 going into 2000, interesting moment. But where else, like, oh, this is another pivotal time. This is, how would you be there?
That's a great question. I think sometimes I was simply thinking about the season, you know, sort of the exact, I wanted, you know, the accident when it happens. I wanted it to be very late summer, just before school starts. I did look at Star Walk, at some of what the constellations would look like in the night sky in certain of those dates, because I knew Waldo would do that.
Right.
So just thinking about what was happening in the world at that particular moment, and really the poetry of the language of the date itself, of just feeling like that feels like the date it would be.
Yeah. It's what Judy lastly shares. I feel like you even made the oak tree a character in a way in the book. There was just so much meaning behind so many pieces of this book. Thank you for writing such an incredible story. I love moments like that. Joyce, I may pronounce her name incorrectly. Joyce Lusau from Lancaster, Pennsylvania, wants to know how you chose the title, Signal Fires.
So it's such an unlikely story. I mean, I've had novels where I knew the title before I had the book. I mean, the next book that I'm thinking about writing, if I do write it, I know the title. I mean, every once in a while that happens. I've also had books where I absolutely have not had a title at all. And I've finished the book and I don't have the title. That was true with Inheritance, actually. Mm-hmm. And with Signal Fires, I did not have the title. And so a writer in search of a title is an interesting kind of thing. Like you start reading a lot of poetry, you can't actually go grasp at it or go find it. It has to come to you. And when it does come to you, you know it. And everything else is just kind of looking for it. And so I was on Twitter. This is why it's an unlikely story. One afternoon, I was on Twitter. And the thing about being on Twitter in the middle of the day, if you're a writer, is it means your day is not going well. It's like, okay, I'm on Twitter. And on Twitter, formerly Twitter, there was a popular hashtag for years and years and years. You probably saw it, Carol, called hashtag am writing.
Yes, yes.
And every time I would see hashtag am writing, I would think, no, you're not. And I'm not either. We are not writing right now. But I always found it kind of amusing. But so there I was, and there's a poet who I'm friendly with, and we follow each other on that platform, named Ilya Kaminsky, the Ukrainian poet, brilliant Ukrainian-American poet, brilliant poet. And Ilya had posted something like, writers and readers, tell me about works that really speak to you about memory and the way that memory operates in interesting ways. And so that is something I'm interested in. And because I figured there would be interesting responses, I went down that rabbit hole. And down that rabbit hole was this poem by Carolyn Forché called Morning. And in that, and I love Carolyn Forché's work. So I stopped to read it. And in that poem was this stanza. And in that stanza was the phrase Signal Fires.
Whoa.
And as soon as I saw it, and also the stanza, which ends up becoming the epigraph for the book, was so exactly right. And Signal Fires, I thought, well, that's, I had never heard the phrase before. Some people know that phrase. I did not know it. Mm-hmm. I just thought, but this is what they are for each other. This is what Ben and Waldo are for each other. This is what, you know, Waldo and Mimi are for each other. This is what all of, this is what the tree is. This is what all of the characters in this book are. And it was, that's what it was. It arrived with its absolute sense of rightness.
And was it at the point you'd already handed the book in and were grappling with
oh,
the
title? Yeah.
Oh, it's in, it's, and everybody's going, everybody, the publisher is going, okay, what are we going to do? Like, what's this? What? Okay, we have no title. It's her new book. It's.
Let me just think about this for a second. Did I have a title? I don't think I did. I don't think I had the title yet. Mm-hmm. But because I remember with Inheritance that the book was like scheduled for publication and was going to be coming out, and I didn't have a title. Mm-hmm. That was a different story. This was more like the file name in my, on, you know, like just on my computer all the way through for the novel, and once I returned to it, was Magic Novel.
Mm, okay.
That's how I thought of it. I just thought of it as it had magic to it. Mm-hmm. And it's still, I actually never changed to Signal Fires. It's still called Magic Novel.
My Magic Novel. But you know, when you were on Twitter that day, just think, you were writing.
It's probably one of the better Twitter stories.
Yeah. Probably one of the better Twitter stories. I wasn't lying. That's really what I was doing. Sometimes I wonder if the editors and agents go out there and go, okay, who's on Twitter and what are they doing? Are they out there talking today? Because that means they're not writing. So I've got another question from Patricia Belus from Macomb, Michigan. She said, I was surprised that Roseville, Michigan was included in the book. Macomb, Michigan is about 25 miles from Roseville. I was wondering if you had any ties to the city. It's a stone's throw away from me, and I'm just curious.
Wow, I love that. And no, absolutely no ties. I know exactly what you're talking about, and I was thinking about that moment where Star Walk becomes this kind of completely kaleidoscopic, in Ben's mind, he's thinking, you know, it's well, not in his mind. It's moving, like it's moving all over the globe. And again, this kind of goes back to poetry. I was thinking about what are the places that are going to feel global, from small towns to European cities to places in Asia and you know, on both sides of the equator, and just finding the places that felt like they would almost form a kind of have an incantatory quality mm-hmm. for Ben in that moment.
It was like, yep, here we go. There it is. Patricia said, I'm also thinking about the tender relationship between Waldo and Benjamin. Beyond that, I was wondering if Danny ever experienced or had an after-death experience like the one she described with Mimi and Waldo in the Playscape enclosure. Waldo also explains that later in life with Mimi's husband, it just seems so believable and so remarkable. I savored every word of this book. I absolutely love it. I did not want it to end.
Thank you so much. It's wonderful to hear. And no, I have not had a near-death experience or have anyone close to me who has. I think I poured a lot of my wishes mm-hmm. Into Waldo's way of experiencing the world. Mm-hmm. And perhaps I'm closest to Waldo in a certain way. I'm close to all the characters, but I've had experiences that really make me question the idea that there's nothing after we're gone. Mm-hmm. And depending on the day, I can go, either way, but I wanted Waldo to be that messenger, mm-hmm. and to know that he saw what he saw and he felt what he felt, because I think many of us have the experience of feeling something that we just dismiss. Mm-hmm. Children have it until they lose it in a way, but that sense of wonder or that sense of connection. And I mean, I know that I every time I think about my dad who raised me, who wasn't my biological father, but we had this like soul connection, I feel him. I feel him with me. And is that sentimental or is that real? I don't know. But I wanted Waldo to really be able to, and I didn't know it until I got there when he tells Ben in 2020 on the beach, when he tells Ben, no, I saw her, mm-hmm. and Ben has to actually stop and hear what he's saying.
Yeah.
And it's a tremendous comfort to him. Yeah. I didn't know that was going to happen until I got there.
Yeah, but that moment where he's just explaining and you realize Waldo's got this whole inner, like he feels things that a lot of people will not feel because they're not staying in the moment. They're so concerned about everything else around them. He's just there. He's just, and I'm going to tell you what happens. Well, I'm going to do one more question with you before we head to audience questions. So I want to see that Q&A button lighting up with questions. With Tom Donati, our editorial director, is going to be the voice of God for us. So I'm doing one more and then you guys are on. So you also narrated the audio and you've narrated all of your books. You're a very good narrator as well. What was the experience like doing this with this book in particular? Going back in time, you're going through, yes, in your memoirs, you're going through emotion, but here you're going through emotion of character and bringing those characters' emotions to the page, which is mm-hmm. different from knowing your own of the way you're going to feel. And you've got to be each of the characters.
Yeah. So what was that like? I loved it. And I haven't actually ever narrated my fiction before.
Oh, yeah.
I narrated all of my memoirs, and publishers don't usually let writers narrate their fiction. Sometimes they don't even let writers narrate their memoirs, which I find bizarre, because unless you're dead or have like a really don't want to, it's your story and it's your voice. But be that as it may, two of my earlier novels were narrated by actors, and it just never felt like the voice that was in my head. Mm-hmm. I'm sure it didn't impact readers in that way, but it didn't, like, I did not want to listen to it. Mm-hmm. And because I had all this experience narrating my memoirs, and because I have this podcast that so people know my voice from the podcast, I asked to. And they hesitated for a couple of minutes, and then they decided, no, yes, this was a good idea. I absolutely loved narrating Signal Fires more than I've loved narrating my memoirs, because when you're narrating your own memoir, the experience is a little bit like being trapped in this little booth with you at every age you've ever been. It's intense. I guess that's what I would say. It's intense.
Every emotion comes back again. Yeah. Like, do it again.
And I was honored, you know, like, to be able to do it, but also because of my own history and story and finding out that I hadn't known the truth of my life for so long, I also end up narrating these memoirs and thinking, oh, here's a moment right here where I had no idea, that kind of thing, right? So it's very intense. With Signal Fires, it felt a little bit like a performance, but not an actory kind of performance. It felt like, oh no, I know each of the voices of these characters. And because I've been, my audio director, when we first started, I asked him, I said, I don't have to do voices, right? Because, you know, sometimes in audiobooks you hear that, and he said, like, God, no, please don't do voices. So it was about inflection and about thinking, how does Shankman speak, and how does Waldo speak, and Mimi, and I embodied each one of them, mm-hmm, in this way that was very satisfying. I loved doing it.
Yeah, it's like you were shepherding them. You were shepherding the characters through the story, and you're giving them the life you wanted them to have. And their voices. Yeah,
exactly. And I should add here, in case it doesn't come up, that I'm writing the pilot. I'm writing the TV pilot for Signal Fires.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Oh, wow.
It's in development to be a limited TV series. And that's a very similar feeling, because I get to live with them longer. Yeah. And I get to think of their lives beyond the pages of the book. I get to think about, well, I mean, I can add eras and, you know, decades and, you know, things that weren't in the novel that could have been in the novel if it had been, you know, 10,000 pages long. Mm-hmm. And that's really exciting to me. It also means I don't have to let go of them yet.
No. Who's it attached to? It's like Hulu, Apple. Do you know who it was it with?
There's a studio involved, and then two producers, okay, two production companies that are both amazing. And so they brought me in to write the pilot, and then we'll know.
Then you'll know what you're going to do from there.
Yeah.
But isn't it like so different sitting writing, because you're going to write for TV and it's like words come down on the page. There are things you don't have to do because it's going to be, but in right, out left, this, that, the other thing.
It's important. So different. It's so different. But I'm married to a screenwriter. Mm-hmm. So I've been reading, that kind of work for a long time.
Yeah.
And that doesn't mean I know how to do it, but it's a really interesting creative challenge, because it can go anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. And that's kind of thrilling.
Yeah. It's like, I can take these characters and do I want to tell a different kind of the story? Do I want to do a different side of the story? But it'll still going to work. It's still going to be able to come on the screen. And some things work on screen better than they work on page. Sometimes it goes the other way, because you're going to be able to tell a story more visually. Yes. And there's a glance. You can do a glance where you can't do a glance on a page. You can
That's
do
exactly a smirk. Right.
You can do all these things that you can't do on the page quite the same way. You can say it, but
yeah.
Okay, now I'm going to our very smart audience, because I know we have a very bright audience out there. Tom, do they have great questions like I think they do?
Yeah, you are right. We do have some really good questions. First, from Anna, how did you decide on Waldo's name? As a teacher, I have known many children by many names, but I always remember the unique or rarely used names. Waldo stuck with me.
I think that Waldo was just always Waldo. And then I came to understand as I was writing the book that I don't think of myself as the author in a way. I think of myself as following the characters. But the moment where Shankman thinks, oh no, he's not going to be a biblical name. He's not going to be, you know, the names that, you know, Alice and I have discussed, he's special and he's been born in this special way. And Waldo, you know, and I was thinking about Ben's relationship to Emerson, and it all kind of just felt right that it needed to be. And I got a little pushback. One writer friend of mine said, oh, people are going to say, where's Waldo? And I was like, well, then if they do, then I haven't done my job. So,
Another Waldo related question. How much science did you have to learn to get into Waldo's mind?
I followed Waldo in that regard. You know, when we first get to know him, he's 11 years old. I read everything I could put my hands on that would have been published at that time, that a precocious 11-year-old boy really interested in the cosmos would have read. And so I really kind of just stayed as like sort of in sync with Waldo as I could. I didn't get ahead of him. I didn't feel like I needed to become an expert. I didn't need to know more than Waldo, but I needed to know just enough to be able to sort of channel what his, you know, like where his mind would go.
Makes sense.
Sue says, having lost my mother to a 13-year battle with Alzheimer's, I was drawn to how well you captured Ben and Mimi's relationship in the face of this disease, as well as Mimi's struggle with it. I'm curious how you were able to write the storyline and these characters so beautifully.
Thank you. My mother-in-law had a long struggle with Alzheimer's, and I was very close to her and watched from the very, very, you know, and she's one of five sisters, three of whom succumbed to Alzheimer's. So it's personal. It's part of, you know, my things that I think about. And one of the things I noticed about my mother-in-law, and I didn't realize this until later, you know, writers are the last to know so often. But I realized that what she remembered, like what she felt, and this isn't true of all Alzheimer's patients, but it was true of her, what she felt was love. Like what she could remember was love. And so when she couldn't remember anybody's name or who anybody was, went to visit her, and our son was with us, and he had been sick as a baby, and she had a very, very intense relationship with him because of that, or, you know, relationship to him, feelings about him. And, you know, and she hadn't seen him in a long time, and she Kanahura, when she saw him, which means like, oh, keep the evil eye away from him. You know, it's a like, oh, like you're so special. You're so, she knew who she was loving. She didn't know his name. And so I think that when Mimi is trudging through the snow and heading where she ends up at the, you know, at the playhouse, she's looking for her family. She's looking for her children. And somehow I knew that. Somehow I knew how to channel. I mean, each time I did something that was that high wire and acts like right in the mind of an Alzheimer's patient, or right in the mind of a newborn, mm-hmm. I really thought, what am I doing? But these were the creative challenges that were so exciting to me, and also felt like honoring somehow what that experience is, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Another question about your characters. Gail says, you write with such empathy for your characters and the situations they're in. Do you ever get mad at them or be judgmental of them? There was goodness in all of the people in Signal Fires, even Waldo's father. Is that just a natural impulse for you?
I love that question. Thank you, Gail. I went immediately to thinking about Waldo's father, listening to your question. I got mad at Shankman. I got frustrated with Sarah too. I even Theo at moments, but with Shankman in particular, it's such a strange thing being a novelist in that way, because on the one hand, I'm creating the character, so presumably I'm in control of the character, right? I'm the puppeteer of the character. I'm deciding exactly what the character is doing, except that's not true. The character is leading me. Mm-hmm. So there were moments, especially with Shankman and especially with Shankman's anger toward his son, where, and the way he would behave to Waldo, where I would think, I'd be writing it and I'd be thinking, oh, Shankman, can't you get out of your own way? Please get out of your own way. You can do better than this, Shankman. Be better, do better. Even as I could have made him be better or do better, but that's not who he was. Mm-hmm. And so I was following him, following all of them, and feeling very, I felt a lot of compassion, but I also felt, frustration.
Mm-hmm. Let's see that.
Paula says, I read this book a while ago, so maybe I missed something. Is there any mention of the impact on Misty Zimmerman's family, or is that not the trajectory of the story? By the way, I was enthralled with the story.
Thank you. Well, wait for the TV series, Paula. in the novel, we don't get much of Misty's family. We get a little bit of a sense of her mother, being a single mother, and I could be conflating things here because I've been working on the TV series, but we mostly experience them, or really entirely experience them in the imaginations or the inner lives of the Wilfs, thinking about them, but not beyond that. I wanted in the novel for Misty to be almost a kind of mysterious figure. If we knew too much about her, and also Sarah does continue to look up occasionally on Facebook, Misty's mother, mm-hmm. and she's haunted. She's haunted by what's happened to this family as a result of this loss.
Yeah, she could just look up and go, oh, this is the day. What is her mother thinking today? Did she put something out? Did she do something special? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's kind of it.
Yes.
But in the television show.
Yes.
I'll look forward to there. Sue asks, of all the different activities you could have chosen to be Waldo's passion that his parents don't understand, why did you choose stars, constellations, star walk for Waldo? What does this particular hobby represent or connect to how you saw Waldo?
I had star walk before I had Waldo. I had my son is now 24. He was 11 at the time that I, conceived of Waldo. Somehow, and I guess because of my own child, I had seen this app. My son was not obsessed with the stars, but I think that that's how the app came into my life. And I love this app. You know, you all can download it. It's free. It's amazing. It's poetry in a way where you can see the constellations on any given night and on any given night in history. And around the app, this boy sort of materialized. And I thought, you know, who would be a boy who would be obsessed with this app, with the stars, with, wouldn't this be, I mean, someone earlier asked the question or made the comment that, actually, Carol, I think it was you, that that star walk or the iPad for Waldo was like a
talisman.
Yeah, like a guiding principle. It was like a security blanket. Mm-hmm. But it really was a security blanket. And the idea of an app as a security blanket, or this, you know, the year 2010 was the year that the iPad was invented. And I didn't know that when I started writing, and I placed all that in that year. But, you know, as it turned out, because then I had to reverse engineer and figure out, you know, were there iPads then? That it was the year that they were, mm-hmm. that they went on sale, and there was this frenzy for them. Mm-hmm. Right? But that this hard, you know, technological sliver of an object could be a security blanket. Also really intrigued me. But it started with the app.
It's something hard, not soft too. It's a security blanket, but it's not what you would normally be taking, but it's this hard thing that's full of knowledge. And it was Waldo to play with the knowledge. And he had this thing that could answer any question he had as far as he was concerned.
Yes. And locate him, let him know where he was in the world.
Mm-hmm. Big deal.
Rosalind is curious to know, what is your connection to Sarasota?
To
Sarasota.
Sarasota.
Oh, to Sarasota. Well, my in-laws had a place there. My brother-in-law still has a place there, or has a place there now. It felt like where Shankman might go. I mean, Florida felt like Shankman was going to go buy a condo someplace warm. I like Sarasota, and mm-hmm. and I wanted someplace nice for Shankman. I couldn't picture Shankman in Miami. I couldn't picture Shankman in Key West.
Nope.
I couldn't picture Shankman in Orlando, you know, so it became, you know, and Sarasota was the place that I knew, but it felt really right. And I remember calling my brother-in-law and asking him certain questions about Sarasota during the pandemic when I was doing research.
Mm-hmm. So funny, you can Zillow and find a house. You can go, oh, that would be the house. That would work. That'll be good.
Yeah.
D asks, can you talk about your process? Are you a user of the computer or journals or writing by hand? I see a board on your wall. Do you create an inspiration board for the book?
The board on my wall is more like a general inspiration ball. It's a board. It's not even inspiration. It's like everything I love, everything I care about. That's visually interesting, you know, that ranges from, cards that people have sent me to photographs of my family and just all sorts of things. So I actually only did that a few years ago when I realized that my bulletin board had become a to-do list and that it sparked absolutely zero joy. Mm-hmm. And a friend of mine was over who suggested this sort of layering of just things that do spark joy. And it does. Mm-hmm. Every time I look at it, it has more and more depth. My process, when I'm starting something, I usually start longhand, just because it feels like it's a messy process. You can cross things out. You can doodle. It's mistakes look like mistakes. It doesn't look neat and tidy because it isn't. So I start out usually in a notebook, and then at a certain point, if it's kind of caught fire and gone, you know, far enough into something that feels like I want to hold on to it, then I will transpose it to my computer. And so I write on a laptop. I have multiple notebooks all the time that are all going all the time. And for different projects, like I have one notebook for my podcast. I have one notebook for, the pilot of Signal Fires. I have notebooks for teaching, and it keeps everything that I'm doing kind of in its own space.
So when the notebooks are filled, do you keep them in like a plastic box? Do you hold on to all the notebooks?
I do hold on to the notebooks. I mean, I don't do them in a remotely. I should be so much better about like archiving things, but I put them in the closet.
Yeah.
I just actually today, because I'm teaching a weekend retreat starting tomorrow, mm-hmm. and I was getting ready for it. I haven't done one of these retreats since before the pandemic. Mm-hmm. And I was going through my actual paper folder with all my paper things in it. For what I'm going to bring with me, because that's how I like to do it. And there was this like beautiful correspondence between myself and Sylvia Borstein, who's one of my dearest friends and mentors, and she's in her late 80s. And it was a back and forth between us for when I was about to teach the first time I was teaching at this meditation and yoga retreat. I teach writing there, but it's, mm-hmm. and I was asking Sylvia some questions and there's this long correspondence between us, and I pulled it out and it was 2010. The paper's getting faded.
Right.
And I just think like, oh, archives. Like they matter and I should take better care of them. But I basically have that closet back there is just full of notebooks.
The history of the book report's in about 8 boxes in the hallway that I brought home in 2020. And then you start to do it and you get too far down the rabbit hole and you go, I've got to stop, because it's emotionally overwhelming, because you'll sit there like with what Sylvia's got and you'll start reading it. It'll bring you to a different place. And then you have to come back to where you are. And it takes some time. It's a little journey in writing. Yeah. Been there.
I think everything should probably just be digitized.
Mm-hmm.
So that you just have it. Yeah.
Someplace. Yep.
We have actually a few people asked this question. Why doesn't Schenkman have a first name?
I don't know. He just never did. In the pilot, he will. In fact, he will have one of those names where he's constantly being called the wrong name. That would be so Schenkman. But I just felt like there's something about Schenkman's whole life that's a bit of a diss. That's how he experiences it, and then therefore that's what the world reflects back at him. And he feels always a little bit less than, and always like people have a little bit more than he does. So I think, I've never said this before, but I think this is right. I think it's almost like he doesn't have a full name, even though of course he does, but that's how he moves through the world.
Not special enough to have a first name. It's not special enough to have a first name. You just get a last name. That's it.
Yeah. I mean, even his wife calls him Shankman.
Shankman. Yep. Everybody calls him Shankman.
Yeah.
It'll be interesting to see what the first name will be in the series.
Yes, it will.
Valerie asks, when you read the book, did you have a desire to change any lines, or were you completely satisfied with your written work?
Oh, that's interesting. I mean, time will tell. I tend to eventually see things in books that I would do differently. I haven't felt that way with Signal Fires. But I, you know, there's a famous story about Raymond Carver, the great American short story writer, where when he would give a reading from work of his that had been published years earlier, he would have a red pencil in his hand and be, or when I, to go back to audiobooks for a second, when I was recording, actually it was during the pandemic, I was recording the audiobooks of both Slow Motion, my first memoir, and Still Writing, my book about writing, which had not been recorded as audiobooks before. And I would, especially with Slow Motion, which I had written a long time before, I would get to a line and I would, I had my producer was in my ears, on headphones, and I would say, can I just cut that? Or, you know, can I rephrase that? And his response each time, and this is audiobook like lingo, was author's prerogative. I love that. Author's prerogative. Okay. And so there are multiple small things, things that probably nobody would notice, but in Slow Motion, where I did revise and edit a little bit, because Slow Motion came out in 1998. I'm a different writer, and I think a better writer and a more streamlined writer than I was when I wrote that book, even though, I'm proud of it, but I just was able to do that.
Yeah. I can just tweak it a little tighter.
Mm-hmm. A little tweak, yeah.
Judy says, Mazel Tov on the JBC Fiction Award. Does the Jewish heritage of these families influence their actions and choices? I don't recall any real Jewish connections for them.
Thanks, Judy. Yeah, I mean, how do we know what impacts our choices? I think probably being Jewish does impact their choices in the same way as being all the other things that they are impacts their choices. They are assimilated Jews. And I was aware as I was writing the book that I was, and it's interesting because I think if I were writing it right now, I would have to think of it differently. Mm-hmm. But when I was writing it, the feeling of being Jewish in America in a suburb of New York City where everybody kind of migrated there at the same time, lived there for a time in this place that was, you know, a pretty Jewish neighborhood. And their memories are things that have Jewish content, like Sarah thinking about Noah Kantrowitz throwing up in the bushes after his bar mitzvah, or, certain bits of language, or just this sort of sense that they're part of a world that, you know, they go to the same synagogue. They, you know, it's a very assimilated Jewish world. And, you know, when Signal Fires came out, early on, a reader wrote to me, a Jewish reader wrote to me and was upset that I had allowed for the Wilfs to be eating non-kosher food. You know, like Theo, I think, eats a, you know, bologna sandwich and maybe has a glass of milk, which basically is like, ew, why would you do that? But it's also not kosher. And I thought, wow, that's so interesting. They're not religious Jews. Mm-hmm. They're assimilated Jews. And I was so thrilled to win the National Jewish Book Award with this book, because it's not an overtly Jewish book. Mm-hmm. It's a it's a book about the American Jewish experience in the way that many American Jews have lived it for, you know, quite a few decades now.
Mm-hmm.
So I wasn't thinking of them as experiencing their lives through a Jewish lens, any more than when I write a female character, I'm thinking of her experiencing life through a female lens, or writing, you know, I mean, I could go on, but it's more of a feeling of this is the water that we're swimming in.
Mm-hmm.
And when we're swimming in it, we're not thinking, oh, this is water.
Mm-hmm.
This isn't a question, but I wanted to make sure I read this comment from Christina. She says, I am 62, and the fact that Sarah and Theo decided to look for Mimi without Ben hit home for me. I recently retired, and it's interesting and painful to notice when your children start to treat you as you don't count anymore. Also, my mom has dementia, so your book was very meaningful to me, also because of Mimi. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Mm. And we actually have a few readers asking, what authors do you read, and do you have any favorite books?
Oh, gosh. Well, I mean, I have many, many authors that I read and many favorite books. And my answer to this, I feel, is almost always different. But there are some mainstays. Virginia Woolf, I think of her as my literary mentor in a way, even though certainly I never knew her. I read her, reread her. When I go to this weekend retreat tomorrow, I'm bringing one of her books with me. I always do. I read her diaries, reread them. So in a way, I feel like she influenced some of Signal Fires. There's a passage in which one of the characters talks about time existing in loops, that even as I was writing it, I thought, oh, this is a very Wolfian idea. I go back, and I haven't in a while, but a lot of my early training in a way as a writer was as a reader, reading 19th century fiction.
Hmm.
And I actually posted on Instagram today, my 19th century, literature professor at Sarah Lawrence College, a man named Ilya Wax, who was one of the dearest people in my life. My husband's scanning all these old photos, and we found some photos of Ilya with me. And I was just thinking about how he taught me to read, in a way, mm-hmm. to read as a writer, reading 19th century fiction, mm-hmm. To think of like reading, you know, someone like, you know, Dickens or Flaubert or George Eliot, and think, who were they? What was the, what, you know, what were the lives they were living when they created this work? He made it very alive for me in ways that otherwise had been intimidating.
Mm-hmm.
And contemporary writers, I mean, so many. I just finished Geraldine Brooks's novel Horse, which I mm-hmm. adored. I love Elizabeth Strout. I love Laurie Moore. I could go on. I mean, I just read and read and read and read. Rebecca Solnit is a nonfiction writer whose work I love. Zadie Smith. I love Zadie Smith.
Do you watch TV? Do you watch, I mean, your husband's room, so you watch TV and you do have time for reading? Because I find that I spend a lot of time, like at night I read every night before I go to bed, every night. I've been trying to work out in the morning, so I have a recumbent bike. So after I finish reading the news on here, then I pick up a book and read for like 20 more minutes. But it's hard, don't you find, to like
do
it all? Really hard.
It is. And I mean, I definitely watch more TV when my husband and I are together. Mm-hmm. When he's away, I literally do not know how to turn on our TV.
My husband.
But there's some very, very good, there's some really good stuff on TV, and sometimes, I mean, one of the issues for me is that at night, sometimes I'm just too tired to read. Mm-hmm. I just got this extraordinary little booklet that I think is going to make a difference in my life, but it's really cool. I think Wirecutter in the New York Times chose it as their favorite booklet, and it arrived today. And tonight I'm going to be attaching that too.
Yeah,
I'm actually reading Joan Didion on The Last Interview right now. Oh. So I'll read that. I don't read on screens. I'll read on screens. I'll read emails. I'll read, you know, short pieces. I need a book in my hands.
The books, if it's screen, is work. Work is screen. So it's too much work. It's too much like work to read.
That's right. That's right.
And I remember Joan Didion winning the National Book Award, and she was in Miami. And I remember I had the book with me. I've gone to the National Book Awards Wednesday, and I flew down. She spoke on Thursday. I got to the parking lot, and I said, I've got to go back on that signing line and get her to sign this book. Like, I have to do this. And it was just that moment of saying, this is that moment. I've got to go back because I might not have the moment to tell her again how much this book meant to me. And to have that moment to be able to do that was a big thing. And I can remember exactly where I walked and where I stood. So it's those moments, those seminal things that you go back on, flashback of pictures, flashback of professors, same thing.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I'm glad I went back.
Yeah. I'm glad you did too.
I think we'll wrap up the Q&A with this question from Amy. How is Otis? He's such a lot.
I love it. So I have this puppy who's turning into a little superstar. He knows he's a superstar. He was born a superstar. He's fantastic. He's not so good for my work right now because he requires a lot of energy and attention, but he is he's a delicious little dog and a lot of fun. And we need to, find and locate and relish joy in our lives.
Yes.
Wherever we can. And that is one place for me where, we have this path that we mowed. I live in the country on some land, and there's this path that we mowed for our old dog, Samson, who we lost last December, I guess, yeah, coming up on a year ago. And Samson used to run that path. So now we call it Sammy's path. Mm-hmm. And now we walk that path with Otis.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really, really sweet. And hopeful, and just all the things that we need to be feeling these days.
Is he fast, or is he just like run, like walk, like his little legs go really quickly?
Like, oh, he's like a little steam engine. Yeah, he'll go really fast. Yeah,
catch him if you can. Annie, this has been such a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us, taking the time. I know you're going out of town tomorrow, and you've got a big event, and it really means a lot that you take the time tonight. So thank you so much.
The pleasure is mine. I so enjoyed it, Carol. It's great to be with you both. And Tom, you are the voice of God.
He is the voice of God. See what I mean?
Thank you so much for joining us, Danny. This was terrific.
Thank you.
And to everybody who's here, just a few quick announcements from us. Tonight's event will be available on YouTube and podcast soon. And we'll alert you, since you signed up, when it's ready. Wednesday night next week, 8:00. Our reviewers will be talking about their favorite books of the year. And this is a fun event. 8 of our reviewers are going to come on, and they're going to be sharing that. You want to go to that, sign up on Book Reporter or Reading Group Guides. And I'll also follow up with materials about that. And thinking ahead to January, I can't even believe I'm doing this, at 2:00 on January 10th, we're going to be doing our monthly Bookuccino Live book preview event, where we'll talk about books coming out in January and the first week in February, a look ahead to March, and you can sign up for that as well. And to stay up what we're doing, don't forget to sign up for our newsletters so you'll never miss anything. And reminder, we have 180 author interviews. I have more conversation with Danny as one of those interviews for you to be able to go out and check out, and they're on YouTube or wherever you listen to podcasts. And I'm happy to share that we have almost 600,000 downloads and views of those. And considering that don't have a sponsor and we don't go out and advertise, that's a very big deal. So with that, I leave you. I wish you a happy holiday. If I don't see you next week, Danny, safe travels to the conference tomorrow and enjoy every moment of it. And do a little yoga for me. Okay. Thanks so much, everybody. Okay. Good night now. Thank you for listening to Book Reporter Talks To. Don't forget to subscribe so you never miss an episode. Support us by sharing on social media or by telling a friend about us. And we look forward to next time on Book Reporter Talks To.